So it's Obadiah, it's page 926, and we're reading verses 1 to 14.
Obadiah's vision, the vision of Obadiah. This is what the Sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, "Rise, let us go against her for battle. See, I will make you small among the nations. You will be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock and make your home on the heights. You who say to yourself, 'Who can bring me down to the ground?' Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what a disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked, his hidden treasures pillaged. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, those of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Your warriors, Teman, will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in the slaughter. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not gloat over your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble."
Super, Saul, thank you. Please do keep your Bibles open as we look at this bit of the Bible. We're looking at some of the minor prophets, as they're called, in the Old Testament. Those are some of the shorter books towards the end of the Old Testament of the Bible, which is the bit before Jesus was born. This is actually the shortest book in the Old Testament, Obadiah. I don't know if any of you know anything at all about the book of Obadiah. My guess is most of you don't, and that's okay. It's not one that's particularly well known, and hopefully as we read it, you'll have the sense of God speaking to you, because we believe that God speaks through every bit of the Bible, and that you'll encounter him as we look at this. We were talking earlier about brothers and sisters and siblings. I don't know if you can think of your cousins. I don't know if you're close with your cousins. Anybody close with their cousins? I think many of you know that I grew up in Glasnevin, and I'm from four boys. And around the corner from us, about 10 minutes away, my mum's sister lived, and she had four children, two boys and two girls, who were almost exactly the same ages as all of us. So we did everything together. We went to the same school together from the age of 4 to 18. My cousin Jenny lived around the corner from me. I went to school every day with her, in the same class with her. We're sort of almost closer, something like 1.5 sort of siblings, rather than that kind of distance. So very close to those cousins. And we've got all kinds of relatives as well, that when you go a little bit further out. My second cousin, once removed, I think was the first ever General Secretary of the European Commission, who's a woman. Second cousin was very impressive. Another one of my relatives is currently waiting some very serious charges in a prison in the southwest of this country. All kinds of people are part of our family, and if you look for them, I don't know, you can think of people, all kinds of characters. One of the things that we see in the Bible is that people are related to each other in all kinds of ways, and what we're looking at in Obadiah today is about some cousins of God's people who are known as Judah. There's at least 12 different people in the Bible who are called Obadiah. We don't know an awful lot about the one who's written this. They're not even sure he's any of the other 12 who are mentioned. This book was written about somewhere after 586 BC, before Jesus, and because it happens after the fall of Jerusalem, after the Babylonians take over God's people. And we hear that this is the vision of somebody called Obadiah. And we're told at the beginning, at verse 1, that this is what the Sovereign Lord says about Edom. So this is something that God has to say about a particular people who are known as Edom. okay, there's these people called Edom. What is this Edom? Who's Edom? I think there's a map on screen. There's a map. Yep. If you see in the middle there, you'll see the big word Samaria. That's to the north of where God's people were. To the south of that, you'll see Judah and Jerusalem, which is where God's people had their capital. Though when this book has been written, they're not there. And then you'll see right down into the southeast down here, you'll see Edom down there. You can see that down there. It's kind of mountainous country. If you could see closely, you'd see the mountains are kind of drawn in there. And this is the place called Edom. So what do we know about these people called the Edomites? Well, God's people are the people are known as the Israelites. And we know that there were 12 tribes of Israel. There's only at this point two left. They go under the name of just one of those tribes, which is called Judah. And that's where we get the name that we use today and is used in the time of Jesus for the Jews. Or Judaism, it comes from the word Judah. The Edomites are distant cousins of these Jews. And they're descendants of a man who appears in the book of Genesis that we were talking about earlier with the kids. They're the descendants of somebody called Esau. Abraham, as we said earlier, had a son who was called Isaac. And as we said before, Abraham wasn't able to have children, but they miraculously could. Same with Isaac. And we learn that Isaac's wife, Rebecca, she becomes pregnant, and she's pregnant with twins. And when she's pregnant with twins, she has a sense, whether it's given from God or whether it's something going on inside her, she sees that there's tension already between these twins. And as she's pregnant, she predicts that there's going to be tension in the future between them. She knows that there's something that's going to cause a great division. And the first child to come out, to be born, was Esau. And as I was saying, by rights, the child who's first out would be the one, the boy who's first, the oldest, the firstborn, would be the one to inherit the promises, the blessings that the father was given. Esau's father was Isaac, whose father was Abraham, who'd been promised that his descendants would be a particular people set apart for God. And you can go back and read Genesis, but by wily means, Jacob steals that right from Esau, and Esau gets extremely angry, as maybe you might understand, and he headed off and he married all kinds of foreign women, he had many wives who are Hittites and Canaanites. And interesting, although the Bible, for the most part, goes on to track the descendants of Jacob, which is what most of the Old Testament, down to Jesus' time, is how the Jews track themselves, or God's people are understood. Chapter 36 of Genesis does actually take the time to detail Esau's children, the children of the various wives that he has. So they're given some sort of status, but they are cousins of the people who are Jacob's descendants. It's interesting when you read this, it's worth taking note of this when we're reading the Bible, and you think to yourself, well, who's the Bible for? Maybe you're here this morning, you're thinking, who's the Bible for? And at this point in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there are these prophets whose job it is to say, here's what God has to say. And sometimes what God has to say to the people he's speaking to is really quite strong. It's really, you need to get your lives back in order. And an awful lot of it is directed to his own people. An awful lot of it is directed to the Israelites. You're wandering far from me. You're not showing the nations around you justice and compassion and love and kindness. You're not showing them my character. You're not even worshipping me. It's going to be trouble for you if you don't get back on the right track. But also we see in this part of the Bible, in these prophets, God takes prophets and he says, go, and he tells them to go to other nations and say, you also were made for a purpose. You also have a reason for being born. And it's to know me and to be in relationship with me. It's to be in my family. And so we see God sending this person, Obadiah, to speak to Edom. That these people who are distant cousins of God's people also need to change their lives and come back to God. There's no people who don't need to hear the message of God. There's no people who are somehow worse than others. We have this sense, maybe in our modern nation way of thinking about nations, that there's some good countries and some bad countries. George Bush famously talked about an axis of evil. And he was talking about three particular countries when he talked about them. He was talking about North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. And it sort of allowed people to sort of think, oh yeah, these people are especially bad people. But there is no axis of evil. Every nation, every state has ways in which it is part of an axis of evil. There's an axis of evil running through our own hearts. Everybody needs to hear God and recognize where they stand on their own before them. We do learn that God has a particular issue with these people, Edom. And Edom isn't going to be allowed going on in that way with this issue. And there's a sense as you read these books as well that although they are addressing nations, it's often similar in that one prophet goes to these nations to say something, there's a distinct issue that God wants to address with people. There's something particular that God wants to say to them. And although the context is different, we believe that God speaks still through the Bible and has things to say to us. And it could well be that as you're sitting here, it's certain that as you're sitting here, God has something to say to you. And I wonder, as you come this morning, what is it God has to say to you about the direction of travel your life is in? The assessment of your heart and your priorities and your values. Obadiah addresses a trait that is causing these people of Edom, the Edomites, to live outside of God's kingdom and provision and family. And it says in verse 3, you'll see there on page 926, he says there, and he addresses this particular issue, which we'll come back to later on, but this is the setting of the scene. He says, the pride of your heart has deceived you. The pride of your heart has deceived you. The message, this intervention from God that comes to these people, is that that God has to say to these Edomites, is based on their pride. Now, I remember hearing somebody once say, and I don't know if you think of yourself, people say, well, are you a proud person? I remember reading somebody say that pride is the first sin, perhaps it's the only sin. That every other sin, every other way that we lead our lives away from God, actually begins with pride. Somebody called Tim Keller says that pride is the illusion that we're competent to run our own lives. So pride is the illusion that we're competent to run our own lives. The first commandment says, God says, have no other gods before me. The only one who's qualified, to be the master of your life, to tell you what to do, to show you how you should live, to give you the best life that there is God himself. Have no other gods before me. All other things will fall short. Pride is the sin of relying on things that we've acquired, or things we've been given, things we can do, or things that we are, that aren't God. Now, sometimes people get themselves in a little bit of a fluster over pride. Has anybody ever said to you, or have you ever said to somebody, I'm really proud of you? Or you said to somebody, I really feel pride because of that, maybe your kids or a friend. I think that's different. I think it's okay to say that. I think if you say to your friend who just completed his apprenticeship, and you say to them, I'm really proud of you for doing that, what you're expressing is, they've done a really good job to get where they are. You're not saying, my life's worth is really realized because you've just completed your apprenticeship. But there are things that we hold to, things that we have, that really are put in place of God. And we'll see from the Edomites that there's many of them. So what we learn about pride here, first of all, is that it can have many outlets, many expressions. And when your dependence is not on God, there can be a whole lot of things your heart might attach to that give you your sense of worth or value. And I see in these verses about Edom, the Edomites, at least 8, though there could be more. First of all, verse 2. God says that what he's going to do with them is, this is so that he takes their pride from them, so he exposes their pride, he'll make them despised among the nations. It seems that Edom at this point were keeping themselves to themselves. There's big wars going on, the Babylonians were trying to capture stuff, they were going after Israel and other places, but Edom are down in the southeast, as we saw, and they're kind of keeping themselves to themselves, and it seems that they had a nice and good reputation among other people as kind of honest brokers, which in itself isn't wrong or bad, but it seems that they were really quite proud of that. God also says that he's going to make them small. They have some sort of size and influence, and it must have been something they told themselves that made them somebody. We're seeing at the moment an awful lot of national pride, aren't we? National pride born of some sort of idea that power and influence is what really matters. And we're seeing it particularly at the moment in Russia, aren't we? And even the last 150 years of Russia, through the Tsars into Stalin, through the Cold War, now with Putin, we see a nation whose leaders, at least, are happy to demonstrate or want to demonstrate or some longing to show that they're strong, that they have meaning, that they're meaningful by being able to take territory and have influence around, that they're throwing their not inconsiderable weight around the place. So kind of a national pride. Verse 3 then says that God will take them down from their vast heights. Now, there's a little play going on here because the Edomites lived in nice mountainous country. They lived in the hills. mountainous country in the hills was it was desirable land because it was cooler than the very arid places that were on the flat ground on the sea level. And they literally live up in the mountains and the hills. So God's going to says he's going to take them from there, but also it's a metaphor for their position in life, their sense of loftiness, their sense that they're somehow better than other people, their pride in themselves. We see that they've got a pride in their abode, that their space, what they have, really matters to them. And that's something that exists in our society, isn't it? People who want to show that they've made something of themselves by the place that they live in. And I was talking to somebody this week who has a family, a young family, and expecting a third child, and they've been living with the dad's mother, and they're moving out, they're getting a place themselves. So she's telling me, I'm moving in, and you could almost see the meekness, the almost the embarrassment. We're just moving into a two-bed place. And I thought, that's great, dude. You're moving into a house. But you could see that in this day and age, to say you're moving your family into, there's something not quite as aspirationally wonderful about that. We're people who take pride in our place, who think, well, I am somebody because of where I live. It's only a two-bedroom place, she said. So then this leads to a fourth one. These mountain territories were especially treacherous for invading enemies. They were hard to take over. And anybody who's tried to invade Afghanistan in the last 100 years have found out just how hard it is to fight people in mountains that they know well. And they seem to have some pride in that as well. Then verse 5 talks about how they'll lose their grape harvest. Mountains are often where grapes grow best. And they're obviously a people who are able to grow grapes and able to turn it into wine, which was a valuable commodity. So they had a wealth that came from that. The wealth of the Edomites is a comfort to them. And the wonder as you sit here is how much you earn something that causes you to think, this is what makes me somebody. I think I've said this before, but when people are surveyed and they're asked, how much money would you need? What would your salary need to be so that you would be happy? Right? And across the board, no matter how much you earn, people said, if I had 20% more money, then I'd be content. Doesn't matter. People who earn 20,000 a year, people who earn 120,000 a year, 20% more would be just right. We're always just 20% away from the thing we want. We're an aspirational people. Sense that if we just had more, we'd be okay. While striving for that little bit extra. They seem to have treasure stored up. There's allies and there's alliances that we read about that they believe will keep them safe. Verse 8 tells us they're known for their wisdom. Verse 9, they're known for their warriors. All of these things. And they're a plucky little nation, these Edomites. They're proud of their location. They're proud of their ideas, their learning, their reputation, how much they punch above their weight on the world stage. Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Like to think that we punch a little bit higher on the world stage, that we have this lovely location, that people think well of us, that we're honest brokers. Did you know that the Irish passport is the sixth most powerful passport in the world? Gets you into 183 countries? That's the sixth most powerful in the world, by the way. That's as if you can get one. Or you can get out of Dublin Airport. You'd be very powerful if you had it. Ah, we have this sense, don't we, that we're this plucky little nation. Well, when God is the bedrock, is not the bedrock of your life, once you're living with any hope that's not provided by what God provides in Jesus, then you're open to all kinds of things becoming the hope that you live by. And I want to say something that is directed at people who believe this already. Okay? So one of the lovely things about church, this church, is I love having people who are on a journey, who are just trying to discover about God, discover the Christian message. But it's lovely that people have become Christians, and there's people here who are Christians and believe it. It's a nice mix. For people who are already there, who already believe this, it is very possible for you to be able to say, I believe that God is the King and the Master. I believe that Jesus is the one who I live by. And that if somebody asks you what you believe, you can say that clearly, and you genuinely do believe it. But then actually, day to day, you function with a totally different master. Day to day, you function with something else that you're proud of, something else that is the bedrock of your life. I know that's true of myself, so I'm guessing it's true of some of you. That you can believe it, you can ask me what I believe, but actually, day to day, the thing that causes me my happiness, the thing that causes me my peace, is not that God is there and he's provided everything in Jesus. But it could be what I have, how my kids are doing, what the future holds, all of those things. That actually we have day-to-day, although we believe in Jesus, we have day-to-day functional saviors. What are your functional saviors? What are the things you're going to bed at night saying, if that works itself out, then things will be okay. This turns out this way, then I'm going to be happy and content. And if the answer is to any of that isn't God himself, you're taking pride in that thing and it's not going to lead to fulfillment. Pride set them against God's purposes. Verse 10 talks about Edom's violence against his brother Jacob. You'll see it there. Jacob is the father of Israel. It seems when the Babylonians overran the people of Israel and the capital city, Jerusalem, the Babylonians came. Not only did the Edomites, we're told in verse 11, stand aloof. They're like, all right, they're our cousins, our distant cousins. They're the people who the promise has gone through. They stood aloof. Not only that, but they seemed to gloat, it says, in their day of misfortune. Worse still was that when it was all done, they seemed to have waltzed through the gates of the city and plundered whatever they could find. We know from the prophets that Israel were far from saints most of the time. But they were the people who God was carrying his message through. And these cousins of theirs, the Edomites, knew full well that was the case. And still they were having nothing to do with it. These are the people who God was using, the Israelites, and the Edomites were gloating in their day of misfortune. They wanted nothing to do with God's purposes. Instead of seeing what God was doing through them, they saw the Israelites' dark days as an opportunity to feather their own nest. Their pride set them against God's purposes. Well, what God goes on to say is, well, actually, it's my purposes are the ones that are going to last. So what I say is going to happen in the future is what's going to happen. And sometimes I think of those things, have you ever, I don't know, looked at one of those articles or TV program, Where Are They Now? You know, I was always very interested in the 1990 Irish World Cup team. Seems like a long time ago. Seems like a very long time. The World Cup, Ireland being World Cups is a long time ago. And the kind of Where Are They Now? And some of them are pundits and some of them are, you know, farmers and lands and not heard of and completely out of the public eye. And the question is, well, where are the Edomites now? This proud and lofty nation, then they don't exist. There is no nation of Edom anymore. Just as Obadiah said would happen, they fell away and were nothing. Lots of the Babylonians are the same. Lots of the big and powerful nations that seem like they'll always be around are gone. The story of the Bible is the story that is the true story of existence. That there's a loving creator who knows what's going to happen in the future. That his kingdom is going to come. That his top trump, that God's treasured possession is humanity, who he made in his image. And he invites us to trust in him. He gave us Jesus, his son, so that by the forgiveness that comes from his death, that we could be part of this eternal kingdom that's talked about here. Now it's talked about in terms of land and things, because that's how the Israelites understood God's kingdom. But what we see in the New Testament is that Jesus comes and says, actually the whole world is God's, and the inheritance of God's people is in the entire cosmos. Not just a little bit of land. And that's what's there for those who trust in God. Obadiah finishes with all this talk of this of how this is the inheritance of the people. Jesus says, blessed are the meek, as we read at the beginning. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And that word meek is a word that's like humility. It's the opposite of pride. That when we meekly and in surrender and in lowliness come to God, that's the entry point to understanding what he's done for us and how we enter his kingdom. Finally then, and this is for me as it is for you, pride is a con man. You ever get caught out by one of those scams that's going, one of the email ones or the text scams? You get those in your phone? Like those? I got caught. I pride myself in being a savvy person. Nobody's catching me out with no email scam. I'm waiting for a package from my post. And I get a text that tells me my package has been delayed. I can go get it at the office. Click here. Oh, I want my package. I clicked there. Put in my details. Mm-hmm. Yes, I know. Don't shake your head at me. I know, it could happen to the best of us. Put in my details. I go up to the office. The guy's like, nah, show me that text. Show me that text. I'm like, obviously, check the number, all of that. It's like, that's a scam right there. Oh, pride is a con man. Pride is a trick artist. It's a pyramid scheme. It's bots sending texts. It's a three-card trick. It tells us that we can do it on our own. And what Obadiah says and what the Bible says, we can't. That our hope is in God himself. It's nothing like lying in a hospital bed, knowing you're going to die in the next few weeks, to make you think about what your life is all about, what the bedrock of your life is. I had the privilege this week of visiting a man who is in that situation. He probably doesn't have very many weeks to live. I've never met this man. A colleague is away, and I am filling in pastoral duties for him. And I went to see this man, and I set up and I meet him, a lovely man, and he does not have the disposition of a man who's just been told he doesn't have long to live. And as I'm talking to him, I'm like, oh, I'm getting to know him. He's telling me I've been a Christian since I was in my teenage years. I've believed it all my life. And I'm reading Psalm 40 to him, and I'm reading it out. And as I read it, he's filling in the ends. He lifted me out of it, and he's saying the miry pit. He's talking about singing a new song. And I'm seeing this man who's really, as the world goes, the worst situation you could imagine. And he just has this deep contentment. It's just deep assurance that God is with him. What he's believed all of his days, well, it's standing to him, right there in that hospital bed. He's not depressed. He's just following along, reading the Bible with me as well. And actually, suffering causes us to take away all of those things, our homes, our wealth, our health, all of those things that we rely on, and it strips us down. Well, what do you believe? What's your hope in? He lifted me out of the slimy pits, says Psalm 40, out of the mud and the mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. Obadiah, the Bible, Jesus calls us to say, where's the firm place that you stand? Let it be God come to full life as you put your trust in him. Let's pray.